October the 27th, 1943. Regimental diary. Infantry pushing forward all day. We are bombarding and firing Y targets. Some slight enemy retaliation, but not much. Just enough to fill the trousers. Good news! We are allowed to write home and actually tell our families that we are in Italy. Oh, hooray! Dear Mum, I am actually in Italy. Your loving son, Jim. Rumours of yet another big attack. The rain has stopped. A wind is blowing, so I will hang out my laundry that now lies reeking at the bottom of my big pack. Diving into those dark depths, I pulled out dreadful lumps of congealed, mildewed clothing. Soon I am boiling a tin of water. Whee-boom! An airburst shell. It stops. I rise and see that the water is boiling. I drop in my clothes, then half a bar of soap, and then start stirring the lot with a stick. My idyll is shattered by another airburst. Whee-boom! Was Hitler trying to arrange on my laundry? A German OP officer. 3 rounds on the underpants of Bombardier Milligan. Fire! Ach, Wunderschön! A direct hit on the soap. For you, Gunner Milligan, the laundry is over! Mail, letters from father, mother, brother, etc. And newspapers. It was a field day for me. Mind you, every day I was in the field. I lay in the bed and read a copy of the Melody Maker. Harry Parry and his Radio Rhythm Club are still going strong, and Benny Lee was voted England's greatest jazz vocalist. I often giggle about that when I hear him comparing old-time dancing. I read. Last week, Mr. Churchill entertained a Russian delegation to dinner in London. They were served venison that had been shot in the Scottish Highlands. Isn't it bloody marvellous? Russians eating Scots venison in London, and us eating curried Italian grass? You see, Winston is trying to impress the Russians. The Russians will go back to Stalin and report the English are eating royal deer ski. But it's natural for Churchill to show that the English still have an upper class. That's cobblers, said Eddington. It's like this. Churchill likes his grub, but if he's caught eating venison on his tod, the Daily Mirror would be in an uproar. Churchill eats royal deer while our lads eat curried Italian grass. So, as a cover, he invites a load of hungry guts Russians who are pissed off with black bread and onion soup, and they come at a double, don't they? Ah, such are the vagaries of war, Eddington. I tell you, if Churchill asked me to come over for beans on toast, I'd go like a shot, wouldn't you? No, I've got my pride. Well, take that with you. You wouldn't turn down a trip to London with that little darling Peg of yours waiting at the station. At the mention of Peg, his eyes went soft, but his trousers boiled. A terrible head with a dripping tin hat pokes its head in. We both scream, "Ah!" It was Lance Bombardier Bill True, ex-London milkman. He curdled milk just by looking at it. I heard you got some newspapers. Oh, yes, Bill, but it's all cultured stuff. The Times, the Manchester Guardian. Don't make any difference, he said. Only want to wipe me arse on them. True is looking at my tea mug. Oh, give us a sip, he says. True sipped the tea and told us he'd heard there was a rumour that we were... Wait for it, we all joined in as he concluded, going back to England! That was the permanent rumour. They even said it when we were in England. We're never going back to England, Edgingham said. Never, never, never. The war was a lifesaver for the Conservatives. It solved the unemployment problem, didn't it? And American banks have agreed to prop up the British economy. So, they're going to keep this bloody war going as long as they can. They're even trying to get Turkey to join us by the end of the year. Huh, Turkey for Christmas, I said. It had always puzzled me as to how you get a neutral country to go to war. I mean, what do you say? Come on in, the killing's lovely. I know people, ordinary blokes, who like war, said True, sipping more of my tea. Who, said Engine, who's now unexplainably removing his trousers. Little, Gun Little, that's who. But what about him? Well, he told me he likes the war. Did he give a reason? Yeah. He said in peacetime he was so skint he had to wear his brother's left-off clothes. In fact, his battle dress was the first bit of new clothing he'd ever had. Until he joined the Kate, he'd never even been put in charge of a job, that job being shithouse orderly. Oh, he's in charge of the job all right, said Edgington, who was now scrutinising the inside of his trousers. He's in charge of every job that we do. True sipped more of my tea. "What are you doing, Eddington?" I said. "I think I've got a flea in me trousers, or something that bites." "Something that bites," I said, sitting up. "Could it be a tiger?" True sipped more of my tea. "Tar," he said, and handed me back an empty mug. Now, whenever there's a reunion, I walk straight up to him and say, "Give us a sip." I take his beer, drain it to the bottom, and say, "Remember Italy." I don't think he does. Something strange. The dates, October 28, 29, and 30, my diary, are all blank, save an oblique line drawn across them with the words, "You've had it." What was it I had had, I cannot recall. I've looked up letters and diaries, and the only document that exists of those 3 days is this unfinished letter. "My dear Beryl, a few hasty lines to let you know how much I'm enjoying this bloody awful war. I'm really browned off." The girl Beryl was a mixture of singer, sweetheart, and friend. She had sung with Carl Barrow's band before and during the war. The letter seemed to suggest that I was fed up. Well, I can't remember, so I must have been fed up. Of course, I might have been fed down, or I might have been fed sideways, or fed intravenously. No one will ever know. Why I never finished that letter to Beryl is likewise a mystery. A bigger mystery is, why did I keep it all these years? Did I intend to finish it? Yes, of course. I'll write at the bottom, "That's all for now, darling. Love, Spike." Another wartime mystery solved, folks. Age gunner finds lost love letter in old army socks. "Thanks to that sock," says 159-year-old ex-gunner Millington, "I have discovered my lost love. Now we shall be married and live happily ever after until tomorrow." October 31st, 1943. My diary. Lovely day. Padre Hill Church Service. Alfal's diary. Lazy day. Fry-ups. Dean's coffee. November 1st, 1943. Regimental diary. I can't resist reporting this entry. Had orders to move from 083857 by 1000 hours as X Corps want to come into the area. The orders from 2 Agra were vague, and they were unable to indicate any hide area for us to go to. They could not tell us where the enemy were. They could not tell us whether we were to go into action that day or not. So we aren't doing anything, are we? Any questions, folks? Ted Lawrence, our dispatch rider, comes up and says, "Jerry's retreating." He ought to know. He's just stamped his bare foot on a dog end and come hot foot from HQ. We've all got to be ready to move at a moment's notice. A mad rush as we start hurling our crappy clobber into big pack, small pack, kit bag, cardboard boxes, brown paper parcels, all held together by miles of knotted string and bits of bent wire. It was really terrible to see what a once immaculate battery looked like. No longer did we appear as conquerors, no. We looked like families of impoverished Armenian refugees fleeing the Turkish slaughter. Bundles of canvas, tea chests and waterproof sheeting were piled on the roof, obliterating the outline of the lorry, which, in silhouette, appeared to be an extinct dinosaur. So, from our Wembley exhibition site, we all started to slither and slide to the main road. My God, what a mess! Vehicles were everywhere, all pointing the wrong way. The giant scammer lorries with guns in tow had all jackknifed. Red-faced sergeants were yelling abuse at the drivers, who in turn yelled abuse at the gunners, who pointed accusingly back at the sergeants. The signallers, us, are all okay. We are sitting in our trucks and have managed to get to the main road, known as Route 6, facing the right way. We have brewed up. Great steaming mugs of tea are jamming the roadway. American trucks with coloured drivers are racing past, shouting, "Out of the way, limey white trash!" And we shout back, "Fuck Joe Louis!" We drink tea till our bladders are crippled and the tannic acid showed red through our skin, by which time the great guns had finally been extricated from the mud. By 11 o'clock, we are in convoy again, looking like council dust carts on the move. "Oh! Look what's coming up the road. It's our leader, General Mark Clark. God bless you, sir." He is seated in a jeep with 4 stars on the front. His driver, I swear, was W.C. Fields. As he passes down our line, he grins at the good-natured shouting, "Got any spare dollars, mate? Why are we getting bloody ice cream like your lot?" He stopped at the head of our column, stood up, talked to his driver, turned round and came back again. He turned and gave a wave as he disappeared round the corner. Had he gone? No. A moment later, he backs into view, followed by a great tank recovery lorry. He waits patiently as the monster manoeuvres round the bend, and then he goes off again. We're moving! Better still, we're moving forward. Unbelievable! The silvery cheer is heard. Our destination is map reference 018908. What will that be? All these bloody numbers, said Edgington. Everything is numbers. I'm a number. Your number. The truck's a number. The World War is number 2. The pills they give us, what are they, Reginald? Number 9. Yes, Kings of England from the right number. George 1, George 2, George 3, William the 1, James the 2. I was babbling on like this when the beckoning face of Sergeant King appears. Ah, he is. Who has been hiding from his nice sergeant? He is looking at me. You are to go with our dearly beloved Major Jenkins forward in search of A, the enemy, and B, an OP. Soon I am in G-truck with Spike Deans, Vic Nash, and Lieutenant Wright. I'm not actually with Major Jenkins. He's in H-truck. Behind us is X-truck. What's happened to all the numbers? In the back of the truck, the ever-inventive Bombardier Deans opens the pontoon school. I'll be banker, said Deans. Why? I said. Because I thought of it. We should draw for it, I protested. Then you'll have to use your card, said Deans. I haven't got any, I said. Then I'm banker, he said. Because I have. He shuffled the cards with great dexterity and dropped them. First hand I got a pontoon. By the time we got to 018908, I'd accumulated a nice little kitty of about 300 lira. Well, I said, I never thought I'd be 300 lira better off by the end of the day. Oh, you could be twice as rich, said Deans. How, I said. I'll toss you double or nothing. We did. I lost the lot. 018908 was a small flat area with a small range of hills north of us. In the base of them were numerous caves. We parked our vehicles adjacent to the line of trees, put up camouflage nets, and sat staring at each other. What now, gentlemen, I said. Pontoon, said Deans. Not in your bloody life. All right. You suggest something, he said, folding his arms and grinning. I have suggested something, I said, folding my arms and grinning back. What, he said. I said, I've suggested that we don't play pontoon. A voice is calling, all personnel over here! It's Lieutenant Wright, who is standing outside the mouth of a cave, which looks like it's going to swallow him. With great urgency on our faces, we amble across. Mr. Wright awaits patiently. Now, he says, looking at some orders pinned to his map. We are now at San Marco here. He taps the map. His papers fall in the mud. Blast, he said. I bend down to pick them up. He is now clutching a handful of muddy papers. I was saying we are here and we've temporarily lost touch with the Bosch. So we will carry out maintenance of wireless sets, small arms and vehicles until further orders. Now that is all. And drop the map again. I clutch Bombardier Dean's arm dramatically and whisper. He's going to leave us. What are we going to do? A rattling sound reveals Sherwood's Bren carrier loaded to the gills with Lieutenant Walker, Gunner Ben Wenham, Gunner Pinchak, and Lieutenant Budden, followed by Don R. Lawrence. They are going forward to look for Jerry. Ooh, yum, yum. May God go with thee, I said, striking a dramatic pose, one hand clutching my heart. Ben Wenham grins back and says, who's a silly bugger then? We wave them goodbye as they disappear over the brow of a hillock. Indeed, the Germans had pulled back quite a distance. Oh, goody, goody. They must be suffering withdrawal symptoms, I told Mr. Wright. It's a sort of wartime coitus interruptus. That night was wonderful. I remember it was crisp, cold, clear starlight. That's if I remember it. If not, it was raining. November the 2nd, 1943. Alf files diary. Nothing doing. Enemy blowing up bridges, blocking and mining every L of sea. Supposed to be flooding plains it took Italians 10 years to reclaim. We're now overlooking main Rome Road. Germans are shelling it from their hills. Sitrep says we must now prepare for mountain warfare. BBC News still very good. Major Jenkins' compliments. Would Gunner Fales and Lance Bombardier Milligan please bring their instrument to the cave? This from Gunner Woods. A royal summons, I cried. What's he want? Said Fales suspiciously. I'd say it again, said Woods, in an exasperated voice with a Cornish accent. He want you to report to him with your instruments. We know that, I said, but why? He doesn't like jazz, so what's he want us to bring out? But Woods wasn't listening. He walked off waving his hand in the air saying, I'm only a batman, not a bloody mind reader. Most certainly Woods couldn't tell the future. He couldn't even tell the present. In peacetime he had been a farmhand, and had known the pleasure of having two great shire horses pulling his plough. I said, what was it like?
Ploughing. How would you like to be 8 hours a day looking up the arses of two great horses?
Files and I entered the cave, which was very smoky from a fire, in whose light sat Major Jenkins, still with his hat on. He was holding his clarinet and playing his strangled version of Schubert's Serenade. When he saw us, he stopped.
Ah! Now, you know I've asked you to bring your instruments.
Yes, you want us to throw them in the fire, I said.
He didn't laugh. He patted the floor, inviting us to sit.
No, he said, you play all that nigger music, don't you? I'm going to teach you some good tunes. I want you to both join in. Here he tootled the first bars of a tune. Didn't you recognize that, he said?
Yes, I replied. It's Whistling Rufus. He was my father.
Over his head it went and hit the wall with a loud plop.
Yes, it's Whistling Rufus, a fine military marching tune. The Gurkhas marched to it during the Chitral Rebellion.
It might have caused it, I said.
I'll play the melody, and when I point to you, Milligan, you play the descending obbligato.
What key? Asked Files across the fiery divide.
I play it in G major.
G major? I knew it when I was only a captain, sir.
Over his head it went and plop against the cave wall.
He'd launched into a very fast version of Whistling Rufus. At the given moment he pointed to me and I played the obbligato. He seemed well pleased. When we finished he smiled, counted two bars in, and launched back into it all over again. We did this several times. He enjoyed it to such an extent I realized he'd never played with anyone before. It was all a new experience for him.
It was a new experience for me. Bloody awful one.
Woods brought him a cup of tea. Woods didn't bring us a cup of tea.
Now, said Jenkins, wiping his mouth with a handkerchief, shall we try some of your nigger music?
What about the Shake of Araby by Rudolph Valentino, I said.
Jolly good, he said, and launched into a chorus. I played the most awful corny obbligatos, and when I took a chorus, I played with the terrible Nannygoat vibrato. Oh, had I only a tape recorder that night, I'd have dropped it on him.
We were interrupted by a dispatch rider from 2 Agra HQ. A short dwarf, heavily wrapped up with knee-high motorcycling boots that came up to his neck, a crash helmet that came down to his knees, and a khaki scarf wrapped around the lower half of his face. Jenkins saw the word urgent on the envelope, hastily dropped his clarinet, stood up to read the message. It would have been exactly the same sitting down, but standing up gave him height. What it didn't give him was a view of his clarinet rolling slowly into the fire. We let it burn a few moments, and when it was too late, said, "Oh, sir, quick, your clarinet is on fire." Rather like those French translations, "Oh, the clarinet of my cousin has been struck by lightning." He rushed to the smoldering instrument, letting the top-secret message fall into the fire. "My God," he wailed, "my father gave me this."
"He won't have to give it to you when he sees you again," I thought.
Meanwhile, his top-secret message was now burning merrily. We left him trying to read it. I had put my pup tent outside a bank surrounding a field. I lay in my bed and wondered if the helmsman's face was still showing white through the wheelhouse. And where was that man Edgington, sometimes known as Ed Ying Tong? The last two words would have become a song that came third in the hit parade of the late 1950s. Edgington was even now speeding through the night in a traffic jam, as the whole battery were homing in our position, and they would be with us in dribs and drabs throughout the night. I listened, and I could hear the first dribs arriving, followed by the drabs.
"Where's the cookhouse?" could be heard.
Food, the bloody army, food mad. A posh voice. "The cookhouse is over there, and there'll be a hot meal in half an hour." Now, I'd already had my dinner, and my watch said 11:50. It was very late. I was tired, warm and comfortable, and I wasn't hungry. At 12:30, I find myself in the queue. Ahead of me is another stomach on legs, Kidgel. The nearer he got to the serving table, the more silent and tense he became. When there was only one man to go, Kidgel would be dead silent. Sweat would appear on his brow. You could see him repeatedly swallowing the excess of saliva that was mounting in his mouth and nearly drowning him. Then it was his turn. There was nothing twixt him and the bubbling, steaming food containers. His trembling hands would hold out his dixies. He would crouch forward like a sprinter in the blocks. His eyes would extend from his head like organ stops. The moment the last drop of gravy from the cook's spoon had finally fallen in his tin, Kidgel would start eating immediately.
as he walked to a spot to sit down. By the time he got there, he'd finished the main course and was into the duff. This gone, he would gallop back to the queue, hoping to get seconds. If he thought he was going to be recognised, he would put his tin hat on and keep his head well down to hide his face. What gave him away was his dribbling, drooling and shaking hand when he got near the grub. He earned his title, the Famine. "I reckon," said our cook, "if he got to a field of wheat first, the locusts wouldn't stand a bloody chance." Another day at San Marco. Gandhi's legs, Edgington reads aloud from a soggy Daily Mirror, rapidly becoming an antique. "What about Gandhi's legs?" I said. "Out here in Italy, there had been no news of Gandhi's legs since we landed." "It says here," Edgington continues, "Gandhi's legs are the thinnest political legs in the world." "Rubbish," I said. "My mother has the thinnest legs in the world. She has legs like old pipe cleaners." "Ah," he said, "but she has non-political thin legs. We're talking about political thin legs." "My mother voted Labour. She walked to the polling booth, and of course her legs were political." Fuller sticks his head in the tent. "We're moving." "Moving," I said. "I can't feel a thing." "There's not enough mud in here," chuckled Fuller. "The Major is reckoning for a quagmire." "When?" said Edgington mournfully. "Tomorrow, 0600 hours. "Why do wars always have to be so bloody early? It's always 0400, 0500, 0600. What's wrong with 11:30, eh? Who feels like fighting at bloody dawn? A man is much braver at 11:30. I left him raving in his damp tent as I went to man the number 22 wireless set that kept us in contact with RHQ. It was 20:30. I went to relieve Ernie Hart, who was dutifully asleep on his set with headphones on. With the true camaraderie, I left him there and went back to bed. I'm awakened at midnight by an enraged Ernie Hart. "Look at the time! You were supposed to relieve me at 8:30. "Well, I did, but you was a kip, weren't you? I didn't have the heart to wake you, Ernie." The staccato ratter plan of rain drops on the canvas roof as the deluge started. Do I have to get up, Ernie?" "Yes, you bloody will do. It's 11:20. You got 5 minutes to do." "Bugger." I sat at the set for 5 minutes. I called RHQ to test the signals.
"Hello, Dog Easy Fox. Dog Easy Fox. Abel Baker Charlie calling, over."
"Hello, Abel Baker Charlie. Dog Easy Fox answering. Needing your strength liner. Strength liner, over."
"Okay, Dog Easy Fox, over and out."
I twiddled the dial till I get AFN Naples.
"It's Artie Shaw. He's playing the blues."
He's really a more elegant player than Goodman, though Goodman was near to real jazz. Gunnerbert, bleary-eyed, coughing, comes to relieve me.
"You're 5 minutes late," I said in Lance Bonnier's voice.
Sorry, Bomb, I couldn't find my boots." "Where'd you leave them?" I said. "London," he said. I climb out of the truck. He puts on the headphones. He listens.
"This isn't RHQ," he says.
"Yes, it is," I said. "If you wait till the end of the tune, you'll hear Field Marshal Montgomery announce the next dance." "Look, Bomb," he says patiently, "why not help shorten the war and hand in your stripe?" "I can't. It covers a hole in my sleeve." As I walk back in the drenching rain, I see a red glow in the northern sky. It gets brighter and brighter, then darkness, followed by a low rumbling of a distant explosion. Some poor swine must have been killed in that, I thought. And then I thought, fuck him, and went to bed. My blankets are all damp and cold. I don't know how we didn't all die of pulmonary ailments. Perhaps I was dead. Perhaps we were all dead. And this was hell. Of course, that's it. We're all dead. I shout in the night, good news! We're all dead! We're all dead! I'd asked my father for player cigarettes, but no. I get passing clouds. Why? Because he's a snob. At his officer's mess, he has made it clear that he would never drink inferior wine and smoke inferior tobacco. The reason was simple. He was skint. Gunnerwhite thought their flat Turkish shape was due to pressure in transit and proceeded to roll them until they were round. I'm smoking in the dark. The roar of the rain is wonderful. It drowns out all sounds except the ghastly yawn from Edgington's tent.
"Harry, that you?"
"Just a minute. I'm putting my jaw back."
"You still awake?"
"Just."
"I wonder what it's like in London."
"Don't make me homesick.
I bet all the nightclubs are open. Some of the big bands will be still playing there. Remember? Ambrose, Loosestone, all that lot. They go on till 3 a.m. You ever been to a nightclub?"
There's no reply. He was unconscious. I must hurry and catch him up. Saturday, November the 6th, 1943. Very cold. We must be high up, Edgington was announcing. Why must we be high up, I inquire? Because we are sitting down. The rations. That's why the rations. The rations? What about the rations? Rations, you silly gunner. Rations. Haven't you noticed that in addition to our rations, we now get little round vitamin pills? I thought they were concentrated plum puddings to save shipping space. For the millionth time, we are in a backer of lorry, lumbering through a muddy, cold landscape. Winter-black trees line our route like dying sentinels. I trace our position as we progress. The town we are passing through is... Tiano! Tiano! I tell Edgington, this is where Garibaldi invented those spotted biscuits with dead flies in and reunited Italy for King Emmanuel the Umpteenth.
Oh, I am thrilled, said Edgington. I couldn't have got to today without that information.
It was Garibaldi that caused the Bourbons to flee over the Rocky Alps.
Ah, thereby hangs the phrase, a Bourbon on the rocks. Ha ha ha! Groans.
We have halted. Look what I've rescued. Vic Nash has come to the tailboard of a lorry. He holds a small, wriggling black puppy. This was to be christened Tiano, and was to become part of the battery. We stroked him, petted him, gave him a bit of cheese, and handed him back.
Hide him from Gunner Kitchell, won't you? I said.
Why? Because he'll eat him. Vic Nash giggled. The pup is furiously licking his face, so he can't have long to live. Get mounted, calls an important voice from up front. Get stuffed, comes a reply. We move off in fits and starts. The lorry starts and we have fits. Climbing continuously on a secondary road between Tiano and Roccabanfina, about 1,000 feet up, we sing a ditty off-sung in boring circumstances.
The good old Duke of York, he had 10,000 men. We marched him up to the top of the hill and we marched him down again. Oh, when they were up, they were up. When they were down, and when they were only halfway up, they were buggered.
Good evening, friends! Ching! We honour a mountain road with a gradient of 1 in 4. We all halt. Dismount! We climb out. On the right side of the road is a church, semi-Gothic style. Just behind it is the vicarage. The road opposite flanks a high bank with several footpaths leading up to a cave set in a sort of browny-red sandstone. That's it, said Bombardier Fuller, riding up on his motorbike. That cave. Get all the command post stuff into that cave. We struggled and strained with all the bloody stuff we'd carried so many times before. Edgington had delivered the oriental carrying posture, balancing a battery on his head. We all copy and march Indian file up the slope, chanting,
Stand it away, stand it strong, mooyaye.
How long is this going to last, he says. With time off for good conduct, by the time you're 80, the future will be all yours. Lieutenant Button hovers too. Has anyone seen Mr. Wright? Yes, I said, I saw him yesterday. He looks at me in despair and says, Can't you take anything for it, Milligan? Out of politeness, I asked him where the guns were. They're in the woods somewhere. Where are the woods, sir? A good question. Get the vehicles off the road and under cover. We all walk around muttering, The woods are full of them. The woods are full of them. The woods are full of them. The lethal voice of Major Jenkins is penetrating the air. We drive up the slope onto a small muddy plateau with numerous trees. We follow a small trail to the high bank. Under the trees we camouflage Jeep truck. Jerry's been shelling this area. Better dig in, says Bombardier Deans. Dig? One thing I don't dig is digging. I'm not the first to spot the possibility of sleeping in that church. I moved my kit in that evening. In the aisle is a catafalque mounted on a trestle. The catafalque's all black velvet with a great black cloth to cover the whole thing. What the hell? It looks great inside. So I make my bed in it. If I get killed in the night, I shall be all ready. Great fun. I'm asleep in my catafalque, and Bombardier True comes in to wake me up from my spell of duty. He's unaware of my macabre resting place. Gradually I rise from my box with the black velvet cover on my head. I uttered a terrible howl. Bombardier True's trousers full of it screams, Ghost! And runs to his bloody life. When I find him again, his trousers are still full of it, and he's gibbering in the command post to Lieutenant Button. An OP has been established on Monte Croce. Not again. Rain! Where does the stuff come from? There's to be a big attack on Monte Camino. The 201 guards are braid to do the dirty work.
I can't lie here. I must do something to help the war effort. I do. I go to the cookhouse for dinner. What's this I hear? That hungry bugger Kijil, he's been having one dinner here, then running across to the American battery next to us and scrounging another. He must have hollow legs. The attack goes in tomorrow night, so speaks Major Jenkins, who for once has deemed to tell us what's happening. How nice of him. I'm on command post duty up till 11:30. Mr. Wright is duty officer. In between firing, he reads the Daily Express. At 1100 hours, the thing called Edgington comes in. It carries a mug ahead of it. Good news, he says. He looks very merry. He should be. There's been a rum ration, and he's had his and a little more.
I guess you're his here.
He poured a measure into my mug. Merry Christmas to you all, I said. He empties a pocket full of chestnuts. Soon they are roasting on the fire and splitting open with a little bang. They taste delicious. Edgington tells us,
Alphonse is feeling groggy. He's got a sore throat, so he's going to bed in the back of his truck.
Ah, there's nothing like a 1,500-weight truck for a sore throat. Vic Nash is coming on duty.
Oh, he says, my poor guts, he says. He's got the shits. Look out, keep away, we all say and cringe in the corner.
The guns report difficulty with the platforms. Mud is making it increasingly difficult. Each time they fire, the guns slither in a circle. We can hear the swearing from the command post. But it's imperative that they keep going as the attack is about to go in. They need help up there. So the backbreaking work of manhandling the guns back on the target continues. I suppose Churchill was eating venison, the bugger.